Well, through the magic of time, space, Bobby Darin, and recording devices, let us talk to the director of the documentary Angel Azul, and that is Marcy Cravat. I've got a hold of her out in California, and hi there, Marcy. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. Thanks so much for having me.
It's such a pleasure. I saw the film last night, thoroughly enjoyed it, and wanted to talk to you about it. It made me immediately say, yes, let's do it. Let's talk to Marcy about this film, because it's something I probably wouldn't have discovered myself. And I do a lot of environmental reporting. And yeah, I talk about the seas being acidified. I talk about them warming. I talk about all kinds of things. And I started out as an artist, an actor, running a theater company. So I understand how the arts can be brought to play in solving crucial problems that our planet has, and you've done that. You've attempted to do that with your film Angel Azul. Folks should know that this. Well, maybe I should let you explain. How do you start when people say, "Hey, what's that film you made there? What's that all about?" I mean, you've got the elevator speech down by now, I would think.
Yeah. Well, basically, it's a film that merges art and science to deliver a powerful message. And the message turns out to be that everything connects. You know, the film explores the perilous situation that coral reefs are facing around the world. It focuses on the coral reef, the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef, which is down off the coast of the Yucatan. And the artwork, the eco-sculpture done by Jason DeCaries Taylor, who creates artificial coral reefs from statues he's cast from live human models and installed on the ocean floor. And both of these are ways to basically inevitably deliver this message that everything connects. And I feel really strongly about that, and it was more of a discovery, actually. I mean, I knew I always felt that way, but making the film, I didn't really understand that's where I was headed.
Mm-hmm.
But as I continued to film and edit, I realized that's what the film was really about. And it was actually Sylvia Earle's words. She says that herself in the film. And I realized that that's really what all of this effort is about on part of the artist and on my part as a filmmaker.
You know, you've been working on this for too long, because you kind of casually skate by. You talk about coral reefs, and of course, like so many other living elements on this planet, they're under threat. Last week, I talked about the monarch butterfly. And how it's disappearing, and how we need to save it. And you talk about coral reefs, but you know what makes me think that you've done this for a very long time is you say, yeah, coral reefs, and there's a guy who's an artist, and he uses sculptures to do the work of the coral reefs. And what folks need to know is that, yeah, this guy's a sculptor. And he's taking these sculptures that where he uses live models to create, and he's putting them in the ocean, on the bottom of the ocean. So
right.
It's and that whole concept, I think when people hear that and you are doing it as a way to protect the reefs that are there, because not only are we polluting the oceans, just our very presence helps destroy these coral reefs, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. Our lifestyles and the supply and demand, you know, our responsibility in that, you know, all of that affects coral reefs as it does all ecosystems around the world. You know, you don't need to live near the coral reefs to have an effect on them. You know, as you learn in the film, just the way we behave in our lives anywhere contributes to the CO2 emissions and so forth that end up in the ocean. And the ocean is warming up, and a lot of the life in the ocean is dying. And this particular coral reef is the world's second largest coral reef, the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef. And the only other one larger, of course, is the Great Barrier Reef. And the Mesoamerican barrier reef is 80% dead, which is a really huge number. That means 20% of it is still living and can still be protected. And this artist, he draws attention to that as well as a lot of other environmental issues because his statues all have messages. And some of them are very personal messages about the environment to him as a person. You know, he's got one called Inheritance, which is a little boy looking down at his feet, and there's nothing but plastic, you know, around his feet, and it's called Inheritance. There's another one called Inertia, and it's a man sitting on the couch watching TV with a big hamburger and French fries on his plate. You know, so Jason, the artist, he manages to get his own messages out and at the same time never forget that it's all about the coral reef too for him. You know, that's where he's decided to make these installations, which you're right, it's really unusual. It's not, that's what drew me in the first place. The last thing I could have imagined were statues in our human likeness on the bottom of the ocean. It fulfills such a fantasy in a way, and there's such an allure, you know.
And yet, you know, what's kind of interesting is that they are lures themselves. We're trying to get people away from the coral reef. Get away from there. Get away from that coral reef and go play with the statues instead.
Was the original intent. When he was hired to go down there and do that work, the original intent was to divert tourists away from the natural reefs. But to be quite honest with you, I don't think anybody had really done their homework because the real issue that's killing the reef are not the people that are, you know, the tourists that are trampling the reefs as they would like to believe. I mean, that is a problem, but it's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is the wastewater going into the ocean, either directly being dumped as raw sewage or being deep injected into their aquifer system, which then ends up out on the coral reef. So yes, he was originally brought in there to sort of divert, you know, create a diversion for tourists, but that really didn't solve the problem. The problem would have to be solved by treating their water.
That's very interesting. However, we do have an impact on a lot of things when it comes to our oceans. For one, I've been up to the Pacific Northwest, where at low tide, you can walk around tide pools, and you can see sea anemones and starfish. They're still there because it is national park. They've declared part of the coastline in the Pacific Northwest National Park. However, if you go to California and you walk along the ocean, you won't see any of those because they were picked clean long ago. And that's kind of
it's true that protected, you know, designating part of ocean area as a protected area is very important. I mean, but in reality, and it does help if there were lots more of those, that would really, really help. But what I've been told by Dr. Thomas Garreau, who's featured in our film, you know, the sea life doesn't know boundaries, and the you know, issues of, you know, rising sea levels and warming temperatures are not going to be protected by boundaries, although I'm definitely not saying we don't need those. We do. We need those protected areas and more of them because there is a huge human impact in overfishing and drilling and testing. You know, yes, we have a horrible impact, and all of these different angles need to be addressed because the ocean's in real trouble, and it's what we depend on for our own life, you know, and that I'm not saying that that's the reason why we should do it. I mean, it's one of the reasons we should just have healthy oceans because they're beautiful, and there's a lot of living matter and creatures in the ocean that deserve their lives, and we should be doing everything we can to protect what's left because it's really, really suffering a huge impact right now.
That's Marcy Cravat, who's the director and producer of Angel Azul, the movie, and as a matter of fact, that's the URL for the website, Angel Azul, the movie, and you spell Azul, A-Z-U-L, which means blue in Spanish. Which kind of makes sense when you think of the word azure. That would make total sense. But I'm not a Spanish-speaking person. And I was just looking at a graphic that I came across just a few days ago. You were talking about the oceans and what's causing the degradation in the oceans. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration put out a graphic several years ago called "Where is Global Warming Going?" And it's got all these dots on it. The atmosphere, continents, glaciers and ice caps, Greenland ice sheet, etc., etc. The ocean is this big blue blob in the middle of this graphic. 93.4% of where global warming is going is the ocean, our oceans all over the planet.
Yeah, that's really, really part of the difficulty of the problem. When CO2, and this actually is a great way to bring up my next film, which is I'm starting to work on now, called Dirt Rich. And it covers basically that CO2 emissions go into the air. And when they're in the air, we have an opportunity to pull those emissions, draw them down, and put them back in the soil. But if we don't do that, and the dangerous levels that have put us over the safe margins, if those levels of CO2 get into the ocean, which they will, it's just a matter of time, well, then you can't pull it out of the ocean. Once it's in there, it takes about 1,000 years to cycle around, because the ocean's so deep, and the currents to cycle all of that around, turn all of that around, is about 1,000 years. So we don't really feel the full effects of global warming until that's completely cycled around. So what we're experiencing right now is the very, very tip of the iceberg. And it's also a very, very urgent time, because we have a very short window of time to get these emissions out of the air and put them back in the soil where they're sequestered and where they belong. That's where they came from. And this is all done through photosynthesis and all kinds of things. And if we can do that, these emissions will not end up in the ocean, where there's nothing we can do once they're there.
You've already won a ton of awards for this film. It came out last year in 2014. Talk a little bit about that. It must be quite gratifying.
Well, obviously, it's so fun to win awards, and it's always such an honor to win an award. There are so many good films out there, which has, been a really great privilege to go to these film festivals, because, like you were saying earlier, it's not always that easy to see these really good films if they don't get broadcast right away. Well, a lot of them do end up on online platforms, but, it isn't that easy to see these films. And when you go to these film festivals, it's just, you're hungry for them. And I find that the public is hungry for them, too. And there are really a lot of great ones out there. And so when winning awards, it feels great. And it's really important for films, too, because it helps them catch the attention, of the public, and the more that happens, the more likely they are to be broadcast and so that everybody could see them.
Just so folks know, this film is going to be shown Saturday, March 7th at 11 a.m. at the Chicago Cultural Center, as we've mentioned in the interview I'm doing with the folks from the One Earth Film Festival. There are events all over the city of Chicago. It's rapidly expanding, kind of like the Big Bang. It will be at the Claudia Cassidy Theater. That's at 77 East Randolph Street, Chicago, 11 a.m. Saturday, March 7th. There's also a pre-event screening Tuesday, March 3rd, at 12 p.m. and 7 p.m. at Classic Cinemas Lake Theater at 1022 Lake Street in Oak Park. So there are several opportunities to see Angel Azul. Marcy, are you a diver yourself?
Well, that's kind of a funny thing. No, I took a diving. I got certified because I was sort of delusional and thought that I would be the one doing the underwater filming, because I am a photographer and I do most of my own filmmaking shooting. So I went through the whole course and all. But I had no idea how difficult it was to dive and shoot at the same time if you aren't a very experienced diver. So I did not do the underwater photography. The underwater photography was done by the artist himself, Jason DeCurious Taylor. And when he was in the footage, then somebody else had to be filming him, you know, like when he was deploying statues or something and I needed him to be in frame. Then Mario Sanchez Navarro did that, gathered that film footage for me. So, yes, I do have a diving certificate, but I would not call myself a real diver. I wished I would have had more time to have gotten good at that, but, you know, it's quite a skill, and especially if you're trying to do something else at the same time, it starts to get to be kind of dangerous because for me, because I was not paying attention to the diving part of it as I was more focused on the photography part of it.
And so you actually
important things like how much air I had left.
So you actually started to, you tried this, you thought you were going to be able to pull this off, but
I was completely not sensible. But the good news is I got to go in and see the statues and everything. So, you know, I'm really glad that I did go through the whole experience. It helped me gain an understanding and appreciation for the experience of diving and what divers accomplish. And if I have another opportunity to get better at it, I think I would definitely seize that opportunity.
What they accomplish, especially if they have a camera in their hands. And as you said, I don't know if you probably didn't mean it this way. You're probably using jargon from the business, but you said when, you know, you needed to have Jason in frame. I'm reminded of times when I'm alone at an event, and I will hand my cell phone or my camera to, you know, usually if I'm speaking to a crowd and I want to get a couple of pics of it, I say, anybody good with a camera here in the room? And usually somebody's hand goes up, and usually they're awful. They're just awful with the camera. It's like nothing's in frame, everything's out of focus, and you just say, okay, if that's a person who's good with a camera, wow, I can't imagine what the rest of you are like.
I've been in that same situation.
I know it can be really frustrating because, you know, I don't know about you, but often I mean, I don't have a posse. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
It's just,
yeah,
you know, that's what I would suspect that most directors of documentaries do not have posses.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You're right.
how many films have you done?
This was my first environmental film. Before that, I had made one Artie Doc, feature-length Artie Doc. Now, an Artie Doc was something that another film student and I had come up with. In fact, it was her idea, and we were making these short little documentaries on artists, and most of the time they were short. We did do one feature-length one on a jazz singer, and when I set out to do this film, Angel Azul, I was following along the same lines of wanting to document the artist. I was very, of course, you know, enamored with these statues, and the whole concept of putting them on the ocean floor was just completely, you know, exciting to me. And that was going to be the whole film, which it could have been. There was definitely enough there that I could have made a whole Artie Doc on that. But what ended up happening was midway through the filming, the coral on the statue started to die. And when I started asking questions about that, it became quite clear that they had a problem and that they weren't really openly dealing with the problem. So I brought scientists in like Dr. Garreau and Dr. Sylvia Earle to sort of explain what was going on, and that put it in context with all of the rest of the coral reefs around the world and opened my eyes to the problem that's going on everywhere. And before you know it was a full-fledged environmental documentary. So I haven't really made another one before. I'm now sort of, I found this niche, and the next film I'm making, Dirt Rich, is also an environmental documentary. I really haven't made very many films.
Unbelievable. There you go. You know, out of the gate, and you're scooping up awards left and right. And with any luck, changing the way people think about these things, especially the idea of going to this park, and this is a an oceanic park, right?
Right. It's a marine park, yeah.
Yeah, marine park. Where folks can, they can dive and they can see coral, and now they can see art, they can see the statues. You know, it was, I think we were about 10, 15, maybe 20 minutes into the film, and I started screaming at the television, what are these things made of? What are they made of? You know, and then you, and then thank you very much. You answered the question, but that was on my mind as I was watching it. It's like, okay, if you're trying to recreate what's in the ocean, don't you have to pay attention to the substance? And if you want coral to live on these pieces of sculpture that are sitting in the bottom of the sea, you have to have the right materials.
Right. Absolutely. It's funny, that was my reaction too when I first saw them. My first worry was, well, is this toxic? Is this okay? And, you know, I had a little trouble getting used to the idea until I found out that indeed they are eco-friendly. They're made from an eco-friendly cement that mimics rock, and, you know, it's all fair and good. But I still had to sort of ask myself how I felt about putting man-made things down on the ocean floor. And then I thought to myself, you know, we put things in the ocean every day that pollute the ocean every day, like boats and ships and oil rigs and
plastic bottles and cans and junk.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and here we're putting in something that mimics rock, allows the marine life to grow, aggregates fish. You know, it has all of these other added benefits to them. And is not toxic and is in a place where it's not going to, you know, pose any danger or create any kind of environmental impact or anything like that. And I realized that I wasn't, you know, I was fine with it. It took me a while because my impulse was to react to that. But then I realized after some thinking that I was really, really fine with it. In fact, I felt that it was really a great gift to everybody because it helped open eyes to mainstream viewers that might not have thought about these issues before. You know, that's one of the things when you're making an environmental documentary. So often these documentaries have their crowd, their choir that, you know, it's really easy to preach to the choir, and we need our choir. We need that backing to help us launch our films and people that already have an appreciation and understanding. But the real challenge is to pull in the mainstream viewer who may not, you know, necessarily think about these things, and the environment may not be on the top of their mind. And the gift of these statues allowed me to do that. You know, it allowed me to sort of lure people in, and just the way I was lured in, and then, you know, and then learn something. Mm-hmm. So I'm very grateful to Jason because, you know, he came up with this very out-of-the-box idea, which I think is something now in this day and age with the challenges we have in front of us, we really need to be thinking out of the box. And Jason was just a huge example of that for me, and I'm really grateful to him for doing that because it pulled me in, and, you know, I realized that anybody could be pulled in by these statues. You know, they're really interesting, and they're really beautiful. And,
yeah.
You know.
And the next time somebody says to you, what good is art, you just point to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I feel so strongly that artists and music, all forms of art, dance, music, all of that, literature, film, it's what makes the world go round. It's such it's like holding up a mirror of our time and place right now here on the planet, and it reflects back our issues, our joys, our sorrows are, you know, it's so necessary because it helps us take a look at what's going on rather than just continue on with life as if nothing else was happening. So I really feel strongly that art is super important as for us as human beings to have as a gauge for what we are, how we are on the planet at this time. You know, in history, and in before too. You know, you look back, and I mean, how we find out a lot about what it was like before us. You know, we look at art, we read, we hear the music of the time, we see the dance of the time. You know, it tells us a great deal. I just think it's great.
Well, folks should know, again, that this film, Angel Azul, will be shown several times as part of the One Earth Film Festival. The main showing Saturday, March 7th, 11 a.m. at the Chicago Cultural Center in the Claudia Cassidy Theater, 77 East Randolph Street. Before that, a pre-event screening Tuesday, March 3rd at 12 p.m. and 7 p.m. at Classic Cinema's Lake Theater. That's at 1022 Lake Street in Oak Park. Do we need to give Kath Delaney a shout-out here as well?
Kath Delaney and Eric Johnson were both the fundraising producers on the film and helped with the, you know, trying to raise funds to pay for the film. And they definitely deserve a shout out for that effort. That was a very difficult thing to try to do. Fundraising is always a hard part, you know, making a film. They came on board after the film was made, and we were trying to, you know, pay back our budget kind of thing. And we were, you know, reaching out to organizations, foundations, and online fundraising, and it was a big, big effort, and definitely a shout-out for that.
All right. Well, Marcy Cravat, it's been a delight talking to you. When you do your new film, now, you have to contact me and make sure I know when it's coming out so I can...
Okay, definitely. So, I'm starting on it now, and, you know, little by little, I think probably in about a year and a half, we should have a film.
Okay, I'll be waiting. I'll be hanging around.
Well, I will definitely let you know.
And can I say this? I understand. Are you going to Russia? Is that what I hear?
Yeah. In fact, I'm leaving tomorrow morning for a film festival in Russia. I can't even believe it. And then I'm returning to two more. And so it's going to be a busy few weeks coming up here. And it's going to be quite an experience going to Russia. We're going to be in Moscow. We're actually opening the festival. Angel Azul is opening the festival, and then we spend a few days in Moscow, and then we go to St. Petersburg. And I mean, how exciting. It's, I've never would have imagined that I'd be going to Russia.
Well, say hi to Putin for me, okay, while you're there, all right? tell him to keep his shirt on. And tell him to leave Ukraine alone while he's at it, okay? Would you please?
Yeah, right.
I know you're gonna deliver the message for me. All right, Marcy, thank you so much. Have a safe trip.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about all this. It's really important stuff, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
It's my pleasure. Okay, let's get back to my conversation with Cassandra West, Gina Robbins, and David Holmquist about the rest of the One Earth Film Festival. Take it away, Bobby Darin.
Happy we'll feel beyond the sea, and never again I'll go sailing.